Good afternoon, everybody, and Mike, thank you very much for that very warm introduction. It's really a great pleasure for me to be able to support the Anika Foundation. I was really delighted when Adrian asked me to continue the RBA's support of the foundation. In the early 1990s, when I came back from studying in the United States, Adrian had just taken up the position of head of economic research at the RBA, and he was a great mentor to me, so it's a really privilege for me to be able to continue this tradition. And more importantly, the Anika Foundation is doing fantastic work. As we heard both Mike and Pat say, mental health issues for our children strike reach into every corner of our fabulous country. I think, as Mike said, it affects somewhere or another almost everybody in this room. So thank you very much for coming out and supporting the work of the Foundation. And Mike, I'd particularly like to thank you and the National Australia Bank for your support. It's great to have you on board, and thank you very much. Over the past few months, I've spent a lot of time overseas at international meetings. I've been to the IMF, the G20 meetings, the BIS meetings, meetings of the Financial Stability Board, and meetings of the Asian Central Bank governors. In those various meetings, two points have really struck me. They're really consistent themes through those meetings. The first is that conditions in the global economy have improved. The pessimism that we saw in earlier years has given way to cautious optimism. Forecasts of economic growth have been revised up, not down. And so the discussions are quite different to the ones that have been taking place over recent times. The second theme that's really stood out is the commonality of the questions that are being asked about labour markets. Employment growth has generally surprised on the upside in quite a number of countries, and in a significant number, the unemployment rate is at or below the rate conventionally associated with full employment. Yet at the same time we've had these strong employment outcomes, growth in wages has been subdued, even in countries with quite low unemployment rates. So the common question that's being asked at these meetings is, why are stronger labour markets not generating more upward pressure on wages? And the related question that follows from that is, what does this mean for the outlook for both inflation and for monetary policy? So in my remarks today, I'd like to talk about these labour market issues in an Australian context. I'll first talk about trends in employment in Australia, then discuss recent wage outcomes, and finally, the implications for monetary policy. Now, if I can bring up a chart here. No, maybe the IT people can help out. Here we are. Thank you. On a number of measures, the Australian labour market has performed very well over recent times. As you can see in this graph, over the past decade and a half, the unemployment rate in Australia has moved up and down in a fairly narrow range of just around 2 percentage points. And the average level over recent times is much lower than it has been than it was in the previous 30 years. Most other countries have seen significantly larger variations in their unemployment rate over recent times. The real stability of our rate is despite us having the biggest resources boom in a century, the biggest increase in the terms of trade, and the biggest mining investment boom. Really, the stability of our unemployment rate is an achievement, and it's a testament to the flexibility of our economy. If we look at just the last few months, there's been a welcome pickup in employment growth right across the country after we had a period of softness. And the forward-looking indicators suggest that this is going to continue. Job ads, job vacancies and hiring intentions have all lifted. And businesses are also reporting better conditions than they have for a number of years. And this is all good news because the unemployment rate in Australia is still around half a percentage point above what we would consider full employment. But notwithstanding these positive outcomes, there are labour market developments that are causing concern in the community. There's a degree of underemployment, wage growth is slow, and job security is an issue for many people. The nature of our work is also changing in both the way we work and the industries that we work in. Over the medium term, two trends in particular stand out. The first is the growth of part-time employment, and the second is the growth of employment in the services sector. The number of Australians working part-time has grown rapidly, as you can see in this chart. Since the 1960s, the share of part-time workers has increased threefold to nearly one-third of total employment, and the pace of this shift seems to have picked up over recent years. Since 2013, growth in part-time employment has averaged 3% a year, and growth in full-time employment has averaged a bit less than 1%. The shift in our working patterns reflects both supply and demand factors. On the supply side, many people want to work part-time. Indeed, in many workplaces, employees have been asking for more flexibility for many years, including the ability to work fewer hours. Part-time work leaves time for other important activities, including education, caring for others, and for leisure. Some insight into why people work part-time can be gained from the Hilda survey, which asks people for the main reasons that they work part-time, and the results are summarised in this chart. The most common response is that they're studying. Other frequent responses are that they are caring for children or that they simply prefer to work part-time. For many people, part-time work is what they want, and the fact that we've been able to accommodate this within our labour market is a positive feature, and it's something that to be welcomed. There are demand-side factors, though, at work as well. Many businesses benefit from having workers who work part-time, but there's an element to the demand-side story that isn't quite as positive. Some people working part-time do so because they can't find a full-time job, and there are others who are working part-time simply because it's the requirements of the job they have. While most part-time workers are not seeking full-time employment, around one quarter do want to work more hours than they currently have. And on average, these people are looking for around 14 additional hours per week, although many aren't taking active steps to secure those additional hours. So many people want to work part-time, but some would like to have more hours than they currently have. And this represents an additional source of unused capacity in our labour market that's not reflected in the unemployment rate. Given this, as the part-time employment has grown over time, the RBA has paid additional attention to alternative measures of labour market slack. One measure that has conceptual appeal is an hours-based underutilisation rate, which measures the additional hours sought by workers relative to the total number of hours that they would like to work. As you can see, this measure shows the same general pattern as the unemployment rate, although the gap has widened gradually over recent times. I'd now like to turn to the second shift, the longer-term shift that we see in our labour markets. That's the shift to employment in the services sector. Today, almost 80% of Australians work in service industries, if we define service industries broadly. By way of contrast, in the 1950s, only 50% of us worked in services industries. In the past, it was common to have a full-time job producing goods. In our more modern economy, this is no longer the case. In an effort to better understand the growth of employment in the services sector, one of the exercises that we've done at the RBA is to classify around 300 individual service sector occupations into jobs that pay hourly wages that are below average, around average, and above average. And then we've tracked the employment growth for each of these three groups since 2000, and the results are shown in this next graph. The picture is pretty clear. The growth in services sector employment has been strongest in those occupations with above average rates of pay. Since 2000, over a million new higher paying jobs have been created in the services sector. Some of the occupations that have seen significant growth in employment are medical professionals, IT managers, project administrators, and sales managers. As you can see, there's also been strong employment growth in occupations with lower rates of pay. We've also conducted this same exercise separately for business services and household services, and the results are shown here. The growth of high-paying jobs has been much more pronounced in business services than it has been in household services. For the household services sector, the growth in jobs has been strongest, or strongest in jobs with below average rates of pay. Here, some of the occupations that have seen big increases in employment include baristas and waiters, childcare workers, and aged care workers. So it's a mixed picture across the services sector. I'm often asked about where the jobs of the future will come from, and the short answer is that they'll come from exactly where they've come from in the recent past, from a myriad of occupations in the services sector. Some of these jobs will attract relatively low rates of pay, but if our experience is a useful guide, more of those jobs will be higher paying, high skilled jobs. With most of us working in the services sector, it's in our national interest to lift productivity growth in these industries to help develop more high paid, high skilled jobs. Technology is obviously important here, but so too is investment in human capital. It seems probable to me that the next wave of growth in Australia will be driven by us building on our expertise in services. This requires investment, including in human capital. I'd now like to turn to the second element of the labour market story, the slow growth in wages. Over the past year, the wage price index has increased by just 1.9%. That's the lowest rate of increase since this series first commenced in 1997. The same picture is evident in broader measures of average hourly earnings from the national accounts. And to help you see the longer term trends, this next graph shows average annual earnings growth or in hourly earnings growth over a rolling 4-year period. The most recent observation, as you can see, is the lowest for many decades. From the mid-1990s until a few years ago, Australians got used to average hourly earnings increasing by around 4% a year. Over recent years, growth has been a bit less than half of that. These lower wage increases have persisted now for some time. One consequence of this is that there has been a decline in expectations of future income growth. The decline in wages is seen as more than something that's just temporary. And it's one of the factors that has been weighing on consumption growth over recent times. As households have revised down their expectations of future income growth, they've adjusted their spending as well. A downward revision to expectations of future income growth also means debt obligations stay higher and longer, stay higher for longer than was originally expected. And the obvious question is, why is this happening both here and elsewhere around the world? I don't think there's a single answer, but there are a number of elements to the story. Part of it is that, at least in Australia, is that our labour market has some spare capacity, and we're unwinding some of the effects on wages of the mining investment boom. But that can't be the whole story, and neither can spare capacity nor a mining boom explain why wages growth is low in some of the developed economies. Another part of the story, particularly overseas, is slower productivity growth. In the US, for example, low growth in wages is being matched by low productivity growth. In Australia, productivity growth has also slowed somewhat. Here, however, the slowing in earnings growth has been more pronounced than that in productivity. The result is that there's been a substantial decline in labour share of national income. It's now around the lowest level in 5 decades. None of these reasons alone appear sufficient to explain the weakness in wages growth. It suggests there's something else going on and that has a global dimension. Many workers in advanced economies feel like they face more competition. And a basic principle of economics is that when you feel like you face more competition, you're less inclined to put your price up. This perception of greater competition is coming from two sources. The first is globalisation. One of the positives of globalisation is it increases the size of a market that a firm can tap. At the same time, though, globalisation increases the number of competitors who can tap your market. It increases competition. The second change is technology. In some industries, advances in technology have led workers to worry about competition from robots. At the same time, advances in technology have made more areas of the economy subject to international competition. There are fewer truly non-traded sectors of the economy anymore. Perhaps as a consequence of this extra competition, or perhaps as a consequence of other forces within our society, many workers in advanced economies feel like the world is less secure. It's less secure economically, it's less secure politically. This means that security is valued more highly. And when we place a greater premium on security, it's plausible that workers are less inclined to take a risk by seeking a higher wage increase. One related aspect of the current labour market situation is a decline in job mobility. Data published by the ABS suggests that the share of employed people changing employers is around the lowest in recent decades. It's likely that in an environment of less job security, fewer people are inclined to take a risk by switching employers. There's also a demand side effect, with fewer firms attempting to attract workers from other firms, and this is contributing to the subdued aggregate wages growth. When I spoke about this set of issues in a recent panel at the Crawford School at ANU, I made the point that some pickup in aggregate wages growth over time would be a welcome development. Some commentators saw this as the Reserve Bank governor making a rather unusual call to arms, a call for workers to rise up and demand larger wage increases from their employers. It won't surprise you to say my intention was less dramatic. It, though, was to make the point that a gradual pickup in wages growth would be a positive development. The best outcome for both workers and firms would be that if any pickup was underpinned by a lift in productivity growth and more high-skilled jobs. But even the current rate of productivity growth could sustain some increase in wages growth over time. Indeed, some pickup in wages growth is incorporated into the bank's forecast for the economy. A gradual lift in wages growth is a central element in our forecast for inflation to return to around the midpoint of the medium-term target range. I'd now like to conclude by talking about some of the implications for monetary policy both globally and in Australia. The persistent slow growth in wages is creating a new challenge for central banks. It's contributing to an extended period of inflation below target. In years gone by, the more normal challenge was to keep wages growth in check, to stop upward pressure on inflation, which could lead to restrictive monetary policy. At the moment, no advanced economy faces that challenge. Of course, it's possible that things could change in the not-too-distant future, particularly in those countries at or near full employment. It might just be that the lags are a bit longer than they've been historically. And if so, we could hit a point at which workers, having had only modest increases for a run of years, decide that it's time for a catch-up. If such a tipping point were reached, inflation pressures in the global economy could emerge quite quickly. In this scenario, we'd see a period of turbulence in financial markets because at the moment markets are pricing in very, very little risk of future inflation. This scenario can't be completely discounted. It would seem, though, to have a fair, low probability of eventuating in Australia, especially in light of the continuing spare capacity in our labour market. The more likely case here is that wage growth picks up gradually over time as the demand for labour strengthens. Globally, an alternative scenario is that the period of slow wage growth turns out to be much more persistent, partly for the reasons that I discussed earlier. In this scenario, wage growth does eventually pick up, but it takes quite a long time to do so. If so, inflation stays low for longer, although there are other factors that obviously could push inflation up. This scenario is one in which the Phillips curve is flatter than it once was. It's one in which inflation is harder to generate. We can't yet tell, though, in Australia whether the Phillips curve is flatter than it used to be, given that we've had very little variation in the unemployment rate over recent times. But the combination of a flatter Phillips curve and inflation being below target raises a challenge for central banks. How hard do we press to get inflation up? For a central bank with a single objective, inflation, the answer is relatively straightforward. Inflation's too low, so you do what you can to get it up. If inflation doesn't increase, you deliver more monetary stimulus. This approach, though, does carry risks. A flatter Phillips curve means that monetary stimulus has relatively little effect on inflation, at least for a while. At the same time, the monetary stimulus is likely to push asset prices higher and encourage yet more borrowing. Faced with low inflation, low unemployment, and low interest rates, investors understandably are likely to find it attractive to borrow money to buy assets. And this does pose a medium-term risk to financial stability. Australia's monetary policy framework is better placed to deal with this world than some others. We have a flexible, medium-term inflation target that allows financial stability considerations to be taken into account in the setting of monetary policy. Over recent times, you would have noticed that we've been paying close attention to the risks in household balance sheets. Household debt is high, and it's rising faster than the unusually slow growth in our incomes. These developments have had a bearing on the setting of monetary policy in Australia. We have not sought to stimulate a rapid lift in inflation. The fact that the labour market has been producing sufficient jobs to keep the unemployment rate broadly steady has allowed us to be patient. Our judgment has been that seeking a more rapid pickup in inflation through yet further monetary stimulus was likely to add to the medium-term risks. Our central scenario remains for underlying inflation to pick up gradually as the economy strengthens, and this morning's CPI data are consistent with that scenario and were in line with our expectations. Elsewhere in the world, some central banks are now starting to increase interest rates, and others are considering when to withdraw some of the monetary stimulus that's been put in place. This has no automatic implications for monetary policy in Australia. These central banks lowered their interest rates to zero, and they also expanded their balance sheets greatly. In Australia, we didn't go down this route. Just as we did not move in lockstep with other central banks when the monetary stimulus was being delivered, we don't need to move in lockstep with them as some of this stimulus is removed. Our decisions here will continue to be made within the context of our medium-term inflation target. We're intent on delivering Australians an average rate of inflation over time of between 2 and 3%. We're seeking to do this in a way that supports sustainable growth in the economy and that best serves the public interest. To do this, we need to understand developments in the Australian labour market and to take account of our decisions on balance sheets in the economy. Now, thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Phil, for that very detailed and thought-provoking presentation. We certainly appreciate your time. So as Phil said, now's the opportunity to ask some questions. We've got two mics kind of in the middle of the room at the left and the right. If you would like to ask a question, please approach the mic and I'll nominate people. And no surprise, we've got one already. State your name and affiliation and we'll get through as many as we can. Over to you, Rory.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury. Governor Lowe, thanks for a fascinating talk today. I think many of us economists here will be spending some time this afternoon staring at the charts you featured. You mentioned that a pickup in wages growth would be desirable from current sort of close to record low levels. The bank has a business liaison program with, I think you talk to something like 1,000 companies each year. Are there any signs of stabilisation or acceleration in what the companies are telling you?
Yeah. Perhaps the most common theme that's coming out of the liaison is that the current rate of wage growth is going to be sustained for quite a while. Many businesses and workers have got used to getting wage increases at 2% or somewhere between 2 and 3%. And our sense is that that's not going to change anytime soon. And you see that in the recent enterprise agreements as well, being quite a lot lower than they used to be. We do, though, hear isolated examples of where wage increases are picking up where there's been strong demand. So the demand and supply still works. If there's strong demand, wage growth will pick up. So we see in parts of construction, some of it related to the infrastructure spending that's going on, and in some parts of IT, particularly IT security, where there's strong demand for labour, wages are starting to increase at a bit faster rate. But the overall story is kind of a continuation of recent trends for a while yet.
So the basic idea is we need the unemployment rate to trend lower to try and spark a bit more action on wages.
Well, that would be a good outcome. A lot more people employed and some slight upward pressure on wages would be the ideal outcome. And In our own forecast, we're expecting employment growth to be fast enough to stop the unemployment rate rising and perhaps come down a bit, and our hope is that over time that will lead to some increase in wages growth.
Thanks very much.
Jeff Weir, underemployed consultant. Phil, I want to ask a question about what I'll call your call to arms. I know it wasn't, but it's just shorthand, so you know what I'm talking about. It was a pretty interesting comment. You've mentioned in your speech both links between low nominal wage growth and inflation and low real wage growth and consumption. Could you talk to us a little bit more about the sort of weight of those two links, if you like, in your comment? When you made that remark, were you both concerned about low nominal wage growth, low inflation, and also the growth link? And very related to that, has the RBA done much work on the relationship between real wage growth, low real wage growth, and low wages share of GDP and economic growth?
Well, there are a lot of issues there. The decline in the labour share of national income is a global phenomenon. It's been perhaps a bit more pronounced recently in Australia than elsewhere, and I think it's coming from the factors that, well, some of the factors that I was talking about, these perceptions of competition. Workers feel like they don't have very much pricing power, and so the wage increases are small. There's also been, over time, a decline in the price of capital goods. So kind of new technology is becoming cheaper and cheaper, so there's some labour capital substitution going on. And another theory, which I find attractive, is that there's been a rise in the superstar firms. You know, the superstar global firms are now becoming more important in various industries, so there's an increase in concentration as a result of that, and the profit share in those industries is higher. So it's a global phenomenon. It's not just in Australia. I think the reason I've been talking about this publicly, well, there are a number of dimensions of it. One is if wage growth averages 2% in Australia, we're going to struggle to average 2.5% inflation. So that's from kind of our narrow perspective. But wage growth at 2% with the productivity growth we have, we'll see the labour share of national income decline further. And my own view is that that's not a desirable development. You know, if workers are getting no real wage increase year after year after year, that's insidious. It reduces support for sensible economic policy. So I think that would be, you know, a lift in wage growth would be useful from a longer term perspective, and it would help get inflation back to target. And I think people would feel a bit better as well. And the fact that many of us have lowered our expectations of future income growth means we're less inclined to spend. So kind of a, no, and it wasn't a call to arms. I read in some places I was calling for the workers of the world to rise up against the capitalists. That wasn't the intention. It was to make this kind of analytical point. I think from our society's point of view, a gradual lift in wage growth would be a desirable development.
Thanks. Matthew Johnson, UBS. Governor Lowe, thank you for a particularly excellent speech. It certainly answered a few questions that I might have asked. I'd like to ask a question about something that's one of those other things that might push up inflation. The French government made a political decision to shut Hazelwood Power Station at very short notice, leading to a very large increase in wholesale and retail electricity prices in Australia. How is the RBA thinking about the first and second round effects of this? Is it the sort of inflation that you might like to respond to if it bleeds over into the TRIM, or is it something that is a fairly straightforward supply shock that that, you know, you're worried about the effects on consumption?
Well, there are a number of elements that, as you say, is going to push up the CPI, the increase in electricity prices. It wasn't particularly large in the June quarter, but I suspect in the September quarter it'll be a significant effect on the CPI, and we'll take that into account. Most of those big increases get taken out of the trimmed measures, which is kind of what we're looking at most of the time. The other element that we've focused on is that an increase in business costs. So we're seeing, and this is a theme that's come out of Liaison very strongly in parts of the economy, that the higher electricity prices are hurting businesses. And they're saying, well, we'll have to do less investment or delay investment. So that's another issue. And the third aspect of the higher electricity prices is that it's adding to business uncertainty. You know, the, people aren't sure exactly what the price of electricity is going to be and the security of supply. And we talk to a lot of businesses who say that's one of the things that's on their list of uncertainties that's leading them to delay. So higher prices for the CPI, less competitive businesses and higher uncertainties. So the sooner we can address this in a constructive way, the better.
Given the lack of bargaining power you mentioned in your speech, would you say it's a high risk or a low risk that the increase in headline inflation bleeds over into wages?
I think the lift in headline inflation probably will help wage growth pick up a little bit. I don't really see it in the current labour market, slightly higher headline inflation because of electricity prices generating compensating wage increases. It's possible, but at the moment, given the structural forces that are operating the labour market, I don't see it as a particularly big risk.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Governor Justin Taylor here from Daintree Capital. In your speech, you noted that it would be advantageous, perhaps, if wages growth was supported by higher productivity. At the same time, you noted that the increase in employment in recent times has been dominated by increases in the services sector, where productivity is perhaps harder to measure. And so, therefore, do you believe that the relationship between productivity growth, at least as stated by the ABS, and wages growth is likely to become weaker over time?
It shouldn't, because the thing that generates real wage growth over time is us being able to do things better, and that's what productivity growth is. So whether we can, the ABS measures that accurately or not, it's obviously hard in the services industry, but ultimately the driver of growth in real wages is us finding better ways of doing things, and that's just as true in services as it is in manufacturing or construction. Granted, there are measurement issues, but the underlying drivers of our living standards are improvement in technology and finding better ways of doing things. That's just as the case in financial services and household services as it is in any other part of the economy.
Okay. Governor Michael Blythe from the Commonwealth Bank. We all have a deep personal interest in wages growth, of course, and I'm old enough to remember the days when my wage rise was determined in a centralised national wage case. We've got wages growth that's not responding to the economic fundamentals. If low wages growth is a new risk in the outlook, should we be thinking about a return to those days? Is a short-term return to some sort of centralised wage fixing an answer to this problem?
That wouldn't be my solution. And let me tell you why. This is really the very first comment I made at the start of the speech. Is that our labour market has done a pretty good job over recent times of dealing with very large shocks. As I said, the unemployment rate for a decade and a half has moved within a 2 percentage point range, which is quite a narrow range and much smaller internationally. And that just didn't happen by accident. In the past, if we'd had the type of shocks that we've had, you would have kind of had the unemployment rate moving all around the place, and we would have had a big recession. And a lot of the stability comes from the deregulation and adjustment in the labour market that we've seen. So to the extent that slow wage growth is an issue, I don't think the solution is a return to some kind of 1960s or 70s model. It's to keep within the current model, and hopefully employment growth is strong enough for over the next couple of years that it generates stronger wages growth so we can have near full employment and reasonable wages growth. That's what we're trying to like to see.
Dr. Lowe, Carrington Clark from the ABC. I'm just wondering how the issue of inequality plays into the deliberations of the Reserve Bank in your determinations.
Well, I think one aspect that we've been looking at is the differential growth in wages across parts of the economy. There are certainly sectors of the economy, particularly the lower wage sectors of the economy, wage growth has been very weak. And that's the fact that people now expect their wage growth to be weak is dragging on their consumption. I think that's probably the main element, the main prism through which we're looking at is differential wage growth and employment growth in parts of the economy.
And can I ask you to adjudicate on a debate that seems to be happening in the political sphere? Do you think inequality is rising or getting better in Australia?
Well, it's risen. It rose quite a lot in the 80s and 90s, and it's risen a little bit just recently. Wealth inequality has become more pronounced, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, because there have been big gains in asset prices. So the people who own assets, which tend to be wealthy people, have seen their wealth go up. So on income inequality, it's drifted up a little bit, but not very much. The movement in wealth inequality is a bit more pronounced because of the rise in asset prices.
And just finally, does that have economic consequences for the country? Is that a bad thing overall for the economy?
Well, it has... Well, I don't know. Maybe other people here are probably better positioned to answer that than me. If wealth and income inequality is more dispersed, then it might be harder to get policies that appeal to kind of the middle ground, because people see this kind of pulling apart. So that's a political aspect. In terms of the direct economic effects, I think the main one is through wages, and if people feel like their wages aren't growing anymore, that they don't want to spend, they get grumpy, they're kind of unhappy.
Thanks a lot.
Governor Lowe, thank you for your speech. You referred to the Phillips curve in your speech and the view that perhaps it's flattened. In globalisation, particularly in labour markets, there is some view that, in fact, if you looked at the Phillips curve on a global basis, that, in fact, perhaps not as much changed. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that the fact that labour markets being far more flexible and global, you don't really need to be looking at Phillips curves on a geographic basis, but perhaps more on a global basis, and perhaps that tells us that nothing much may have ultimately changed.
Yeah, I think the underlying idea here is that with globalisation, more workers have come into the global labour market, and if you take that into account, then current developments are not that unusual, because you've got a lot of workers in developing countries that have come into the global labour market, and I think there is an element of truth to that. And it's linked to the internationalisation point that I made, that we many of us feel, I personally don't feel this, but I think many people do, that there are more competitors out there for your job. I'm in an unusual position of having a 7-year fixed term. That's unusual, but I think for me, and I talk to people in Sydney and in Melbourne and in professional business services, and some of them worry about people in Chengdu in Sichuan province of China, or in Bangalore, kind of taking, potentially acting as a competitor. Then these are in professional services in Sydney, and things that you wouldn't have thought would have been contestable internationally. And I think that's kind of really the same point that you're getting at too. There's kind of a global dimension to our labour markets because of globalisation, and for many people it's a fantastic opportunity, and for other people it's a threat. And it relates to the question that Carrington was asked about inequality. It's where you sit on that divide kind of determines whether you think this is a good thing or a bad thing. In the end, I think it's a good thing for the country. We need to deal with these issues about the dispersion of income growth.
Governor Jonathan Shapiro from the Financial Review. Our paper's covered several articles of late talking about the costs of rising property prices, which have been influenced by persistently low interest rates. My question is, what are your current thoughts on the potential social costs of low interest rates if they are to remain persistently low, and how this might impact monetary policy?
What was the impact of low interest rates? The main impact that it's helped the economy. The current level of interest rates, which we've had now for roughly a year, does mean that more people have jobs than otherwise would have been the case. The wage growth is probably a bit higher than it otherwise would have been. More people have jobs, there's more output growth. So that's the main effect. In some housing markets, it's probably added to the already existing upward pressure on housing prices, and that's an issue we're trying to manage. But the main effect of lower interest rates is that more people have jobs, and that's why I'm very comfortable with the current setting of monetary policy. It's helped people get jobs.
Sue Linong, RBC Capital Markets. Governor, is it possible that part of the explanation for the soft wages growth in Australia is around the issue of competitiveness and the need for Australia to be competitive, that by major trading partner standards, while there's been some improvement, labour costs are still relatively high, and that's an issue when productivity is where it is and the exchange rate is where it is as well?
Well, it's obviously important that we can do what we can to be competitive. But I think the solution to competitiveness problem, if there is a problem, isn't grinding lower nominal wage growth. It largely rests on the exchange rate. Because when people talk about competitiveness, they're really kind of talking about the exchange rate being too high. I mean, I remember a number of years ago when I met with international investors who were coming to Australia, they'd say, Australia's just so expensive, we can't afford a hotel, and restaurants are so expensive. And that was when the exchange rate was, you know, $1.10. People haven't been talking about that in recent times. So the competitiveness pendulum swings with the exchange rate. So in principle, if we thought why we weren't sufficiently competitive, then a lower exchange rate would be helpful. This is one of the reasons we've been talking about the exchange rate over recent times, is it would be better if the exchange rate were a bit lower than it currently is. It would help generate more jobs, push inflation a bit close to our target. So that's the solution to a competitiveness problem, not grinding lower wages growth at the aggregate level.
Sophia Rodriguez from MNI. This morning, RBNZ, in its speech, said that neutral nominal cash rate is 3.5%, which is the same as what RBA said. Many years back, I think the difference between the two was about 1.5%. Does it mean you are overestimating your neutral rate?
Well, I don't think so. If I thought we were overestimating, we would have put out a different number. Now, there's been a lot of media commentary in Australia in the last 2 weeks on the neutral rate, much more than there has been in kind of years before. If you look at what's going on overseas, the other central banks talk a lot about this. The Fed, almost every second speech, has some reference to the neutral rate. So the discussion that's taking place here in Australia is kind of a bit behind what happens everywhere else around the world. And the reason we're talking about this, or one of the reasons we're talking about it, is to make the point that we expect in the future the average cash rate to be lower than the average of the past. I think it's kind of useful for people to understand that. There's a lot of uncertainty about what the right number is, but our current best guess is, you know, averaging something like 3.5, but there's a lot of uncertainty around that. You know, it's lower than it was in the past because productivity growth is slower, potential growth is a bit slower, and people are more risk averse. When we were in the phase of leveraging up, it didn't take much to encourage people to run to the bank, to get them to borrow more, to increase their spending. In today's environment, low interest rates aren't having that same effect. You know, people are less inclined to borrow as a result of the lower interest rates, or less inclined to borrow for consumption. And they're more inclined to use the lower interest rates to try and pay down debt. So kind of there's a risk change in risk aversion, and that means that the interest rate is lower than it used to be.
So does it mean the 1.5% premium between Australia and New Zealand?
Well, I don't know. I haven't studied the RBNZ's paper, but I did note that they too talked about it. And if you look at most central banks, that they're talking about the neutral real rate. Probably I can just take an opportunity to make this point again, because there was a lot of media discussion of it, and some of it, I think, misinterpreted our intentions. As my deputy said last week, at most board meetings, we have a special topic of interest. This time it was the neutral rate. The previous meeting was the intersection of monetary policy and financial stability, and there was a reasonable amount in the minutes on that issue, and it went completely unremarked at the time, which I found surprising. We had a discussion on trends in part-time employment, drawing on some of this, my speech is drawn on some of that material, and we've had extensive discussions on China. So these are things that are not at every board meeting, but most board meetings, and the topics are kind of decided kind of 6 months in advance so the staff can work at it and work on them. And this just happened to be the month we were talking about the neutral rate, and some people got overly excited by the inclusion of that in the minutes. Just to people who are looking for the next set of minutes, there's no special topic for the next meeting. And I say that because we've got the Reserve Bank's annual report, and the board has to approve the financial statements and some internal governance issues, so there'll be no special topic at this next meeting.
We might make this the last one now. Yeah, hi,
Peter Ryan from the ABC. Never has there been so much excitement out of RBA minutes as there was last week.
Indeed.
But look, APRA came out last week with its long-awaited definition of unquestionably strong. I was wondering if you might be able to give some colour about whether or not the Reserve Bank had any role in working with APRA on that, whether you feel comfortable about that definition, and just on the housing exposure that in particular the big four banks have to highly indebted households through mortgages. Are you feeling a little bit more relaxed or confident, or do you see a sign that we're not heading towards any type of bubble that could really hurt the economy?
Yeah. Well, in terms of our relationship with APRA, one of the really positive aspects of the Australian regulatory arrangements is there's a really strong relationship between the central bank and the regulator. Wayne and I talk frequently. We work very constructively through the Council of Financial Regulators. We're on the same page on most issues. I contrast that with the experience in a number of other countries that I'm familiar with. When I talk to governors of other central banks, they're spending a lot of time complaining about their relationship with the supervisor, and often that breaks out into public disagreement. In Australia, Reserve Bank and APRA, through the Council of Financial Regulators, have worked together really well, and we have a really positive cooperation, a culture of cooperation. In terms of APRA's announcements last week, and we knew that was happening, but it's really APRA's decision, and I felt perfectly comfortable with it. In terms of what's going on in the housing market at the moment, it does look like some of the heat is starting to come out of the Sydney and Melbourne markets. We've got a way to go. We've been through this before. We thought things were slowing down, and then they sped up again. So, but it does look at the moment that the monthly price increases are a bit smaller, and the auction clearance rates have come down. My hope is that a combination of factors continue to move us in that direction. We've got a lot of extra supply coming onto the market. This year is kind of a peak period of addition to supply. Rent growth is weak. We saw in today's CPI, I think rents are up 0.6 over the year and just 0.2 in the quarter. There's less foreign demand. The Chinese have restricted capital outflows in a way, and there's been higher taxes on foreign investors, or higher stamp duties, and the banks have increased some interest rates, and they've tightened up the conditions, the lending conditions, and we've got better transportation infrastructure investment taking place. So those things, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, should take some of the pressures over time, and my hope is that the current slowing that we're seeing will be sustained.
Okay, thank you.